Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
What you just heard was the last speech Martin Luther King ever gave. Soon after he gave this speech, the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech, Martin Luther King was murdered. And it makes the words he speaks ring more poignant, having lived a good life. But despite the fact that he's lived a good life, despite the fact that he has done so much and seen so much, that he will not stop. Over the past few days, actually weeks, I've been racking my brain with what to do about this podcast, about this conversation. Being a white man, a very privileged position, and I know that I'm in a privileged position. I've never had to worry about seeing police officers. I've never had to worry about the way people look at me and the way people think about me when I'm walking down the street, or the opportunities that I've been given by virtue of what skin color I was born with. I felt that my voice in this conversation didn't matter, that I would just be adding to more of the same people coming in and saying, oh, well, I am standing in support. You know that I stand in support. I'm not adding to this discussion being a white man. This conversation should be for the black community. After the murder of George Floyd, I still haven't watched that video. I can't bring myself to watch that video. Our world has been thrown upside down. And I think it's about time. So this episode, I'm not going to speak. Or I'm going to speak very little. But I'm going to let one of the greatest thinkers, greatest orators, and greatest civil leaders in human history, Martin Luther King, speak for me. I will use my platform to, at this time, more importantly than ever, allow his words to speak. I've given you the I've Been to the Mountaintop segment. Next is Martin Luther King talking about riots. And people have been often quoting Martin Luther King saying that riots are the language of the oppressed. And that is very true. But as I play this next segment for you, the first bit might shock you, the things that he's saying. It totally recontextualizes the statement that he has been often quoted for in the last few weeks. But I want you to listen for the hitch point, the turn point, where Martin Luther King goes from supporting peace to not.
Let me say, as I've always said, and I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating, I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve, that in a real sense it is impractical for the Negro to even think of mounting a violent revolution in the United States. So I will continue to condemn riots and continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way. Continue to affirm that there is another way. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. And it has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And so in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as America postpones justice, we stand in the position of having these recurrences of violence and riots over and over again. Social justice and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot prevention.
So, next, I want to go to a very good collection of speeches made by Martin Luther King Jr., and you'll also hear from James Baldwin. When these issues come to the fore and begin to have light shone on them, on the inequity and inequality of treatment in society of the black community, people often, to deflect away from the pain and suffering that the black community goes through on a day-to-day basis, to deflect away from that and make it more palatable for themselves, people start to question. They push back. They ask, okay, how do we solve this? How do we fix this? What do you want? You have so much, you know, we've made past laws that say you can't discriminate. Well, laws only go so far. There's the difference between inequality and inequity. Inequality is inequality of treatment. Inequity is inequality or difference in circumstance. Inequity is the starting point. I have the privilege to say that because of being white, I started out ahead. In the race of life, I got to start running first. I got the head start. So by addressing that, by addressing inequity and inequality, it's a pretty good starting point.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shut down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well,
it didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. And as I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation.
let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to leave Martin out of it.
For a moment. Martin's very rare, very great man. Martin's rare for two reasons. Part because just because he is. And because he's a real Christian, and he really believes in nonviolence. He's arrived at something in himself, which permits him, allows him to do it. And he still has great moral authority in the South. He has none whatever in the North. Poor Martin has gone through God knows what kind of hell to awaken the American conscience. But Martin has reached the end of his rope. There's some things Martin can't do. Martin's only one man. Martin can't solve the nation's central problem by himself. There are lots of people, lots of black people, I mean now, who don't go to church no more and don't listen to Martin, you know, and who anyway are themselves produced by civilization, which has always glorified violence, unless the Negro had the gun. So that Martin is undercut by the performance of the country. The country is only concerned about nonviolence if it seems that I'm going to get violent. But I'm not worried about it, not about nonviolence if it's some Alabama sheriff.
Jim, what do you see deep in the recesses of your own mind as the future of our nation? And I ask that question in that way because I think that the future of the Negro and the future of the nation are linked.
They're indissoluble.
Yeah. Now, what do you see? Are you essentially optimistic or pessimistic? And I really don't want to put words in your mouth because what I really want to find out is what you really believe.
Well, I'm both glad and sorry you asked me that question. I'll do my best to answer it. I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But the Negro in this country, the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, North and South, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there's no difference in the North and the South. There's just a difference in the way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why.
Well,
and the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
As a Negro, And as an American, I can only hope that America has the strength and the capacity,
the moral strength,
to ask and answer that question in affirmative and constructive ways.
To face that question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.
And finally, I want to leave you with one last speech. This is perhaps the greatest speech I've ever heard. If you're looking for something meaningful, if you're looking for something poignant, if you're looking for something hopeful, because that's what we need right now, is hope, you can turn to this. It's classic, it's timeless, it's something that I think every single one of us has heard at some point or another in our lives and thought, wow, that was great. This is the I Have a Dream speech. This is something that I want to leave you with, because I want to leave not a privileged white guy sending you off for the rest of your day or evening or whenever you're listening to this. I want one of the greatest speakers the black community has ever known to leave you. The murder of George Floyd was a crime. It was. It was a murder. And the collective anguish cannot be forgotten. It has rocked our world to the core. And finally, more people are saying enough is enough. Rest in peace, George Floyd. And rest in peace to every single member of the black community killed by police officers the world over. You are gone, but never forgotten.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the Red Hill,
sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yeah. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. Exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when we gather, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last, thank God."